Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
Sally Palawoda was out for a leisurely Sunday bike ride when she came across a guy passed out. He was turning blue, not looking good.
I've done CPR many times. I'm an emergency department nurse, and I thought this was not going to have a great outcome.
Yeah, but Sally got that all wrong, thanks to some cutting-edge resuscitation science and a treatment that involves putting the entire body on ice. I'm Todd Bookman, sitting in this week for Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. On the show today, we've got stories of cold and hot, ice baths and sweaty yoga, of how climate change might impact the future of the Olympic Games, and how life in a winter paradise presents its own unique challenges. But back to that guy turning blue, and the amazing, seemingly low-tech treatment that saved his life. So it was that Sunday, 4 years ago, when Sally rolled up on a passed-out Zach Conrad.
Yeah, so back at the time this happened, right, I was 36, healthy, and I had just gotten married 2 months prior.
And this is the lady he married.
My name is Maura Conrad, and I'm the wife of Zach Conrad.
Maura and Zach live in the center of Philadelphia in a small row home on a side street. Zach is tall and wiry, unfailingly polite. And on the day he basically died, it started out as a pretty normal morning. Maura, who's a doctor, had just finished up work.
So I was a pediatric resident at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I'd worked a 24-hour shift and had just come home from that.
And so I picked her up and we'd had breakfast.
They went out to a local spot.
I think Zach had a burrito and I had a Bloody Mary.
They go back home.
Put her to sleep and headed out for a bike ride.
So Zach is out on this bike trail, carving through the woods. He's planning on riding for about 2 hours, which wasn't unreasonable for him. He'd been doing triathlons and was in pretty good shape. Zach doesn't actually remember what happened next. All the blanks have been filled in by various witnesses.
Biking along and must have realized that something wasn't quite right and stopped, got off my bike, sat down next to a wall and took my helmet off. And then proceeded to slump over.
He's splayed out on the ground. He seems passed out. But it's actually worse than that. And that's how a woman, a passerby named Charity, finds him.
Looked at me and realized that it didn't look good. So she came over and called 911 and then sat down and said she tried to talk to me while she waited for help. And then shortly thereafter, two other women, Sally and Kristen, were biking by. And they looked over and also realized that it didn't look good.
So Charity waves them over and explains the situation, that she just found Zach this way and that she's already called for help. And then Sally, who, remember, is an emergency room nurse, she looks him over.
He was on his side. I remember flipping him over and he was blue. Not moving, not breathing, not reacting. He was out. I thought he was already deceased.
Sally knew what a dead person looked like, and it looked a lot the way Zach looked. But she also knew that in this situation, you've got to at least try CPR. So she gets her friend Kristen, who'd been bike riding with her, into position.
So I quickly told her, I'm going to breathe, you're going to push on his chest, and we're going to count together.
And they start. They're doing CPR on Zach while this crowd is forming around them on the bike path. It takes a bit of time for the ambulance to arrive, or at least it seemed to.
I don't think it was that long. I think those things feel that way in the moment, and I kept thinking, where's help? Where's help?
They didn't quit. They kept going.
One and two and three and four and five.
I'm sure it was messy, it was ugly, and they just kept going.
Even if this is a lost cause, we can't stop. We can't stop. I know if we stop, he will definitely not survive. So that never crossed my mind, stopping, till we got relieved by rescue.
Eventually, the ambulance pulls up, and the EMS workers come running down the path.
They put on the AED, and it recognized the rhythm and shocked me. And it ultimately, I think, took 3 shocks to get my heart going again. And then from there, I was transported to a local hospital.
The ambulance pulls off, with Zach still unconscious in the back. And Sally is left standing there, trying to make sense of what just happened, what she saw.
He had a brand new shiny wedding band on. And that was really sad because I thought, oh my gosh, this young guy who is married to somebody. I thought they're going to take him to the hospital. They're probably going to pronounce him.
Zach, this otherwise healthy 36-year-old, his heart had stopped due to a condition that's really hard to predict. It wasn't a heart attack, which is caused by a blocked artery.
So I was in ventricular fibrillation, which is, you know, I'm not a medical person, but my layman's description is that it just means your heart basically gets out of electrical sync, and it is beating irregularly or in a way that is not allowing it to function properly.
For some reason, Zach's heart just started misfiring and stopped pumping blood. When the paramedic shocked him, the organ started beating again, but it wasn't clear how much damage had been done.
And I do remember that he was, like many cardiac arrest patients, completely unresponsive.
Benjamin Abella is the physician who treated Zach at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania.
Would not open his eyes, would not move.
While it was his heart that started all this, Abella and his team were worried the lack of blood flow had put Zach's brain in jeopardy. Abella says the hours after a cardiac arrest are really this race against the clock.
And that race against the clock is for irreversible brain injury. And so one of the ways we can affect that injury is to lower core body temperature. We call that therapeutic hypothermia.
Yeah, therapeutic hypothermia, intentionally cooling down the body. So the idea is a lower temperature slows everything down and limits inflammation that could cause complications. At least, that's what experts like Abella think it does.
It's still actually a mystery how hyperthermia works to improve survival after cardiac arrest. We know some of the partial mechanisms, reduction of brain swelling, decreased cellular metabolism. So there are definitely ways that we understand, but it's probably far more complex than that.
This isn't exactly an experimental treatment, though. There is clear scientific evidence that it can benefit patients. It's been proven in a number of studies. And while doctors and researchers are still working to refine therapeutic hypothermia, it actually has a long history in medicine.
Although its modern iteration dates from the 1950s, there are actually documented examples of understanding the role of hypothermia as early as Napoleon's invasion of Russia.
We're talking about the year 1812.
There was a surgeon who worked with Napoleon's army who observed that soldiers who were mortally injured but kept cold sometimes made it, as opposed to soldiers who were injured severely but warmed up and brought near the campfire and given warm cognac. They often died.
Okay, so cognac is out. The methods for cooling are vastly improved, too. For many patients, it's now done through an infusion of chilled saline.
It's not as easy as it sounds. There's technology involved and medications we have to give. But yes, we lower the core body temperature from normal 98.6 Fahrenheit to around 91 to 92 Fahrenheit, which doesn't sound like a lot, but as far as brain processes and body physiology, it's a huge temperature difference.
Zach's wife, Maura, remembers seeing this being done to Zach in his hospital bed.
He's completely asleep, eyes closed. He had a breathing tube, so he was having all the work done for him. He had several different IVs. And then he had sort of these like cool, like water blankets that sort of were underneath his legs and arms and things like that as other ways to help control the temperature of his body.
Zach stayed like this, comatose. His body temperature held down around 91 degrees for 30 hours, kind of the maximum amount of time for therapeutic hypothermia. And those are some long hours when you don't even know if he's going to wake up.
Or, you know, if he was going to have full movements in his body, was he going to be able to, you know, write again? Was he going to be able to have a normal conversation? Was he able to, you know, work his job that he had before? Was he going to be able to work any job? All those sorts of questions that were sort of like constantly luring around. Is that, yes, I wanted him to be safe and I wanted to be alive, but what was his quality of life going to be?
Maura, as a doctor, knew that the outcomes in these situations are usually poor. Only about 10% of people who have cardiac arrest survive. CPR, like Sally and Kristen did to Zach, increases the chances to around 40%. But even then, many people experience long-term cognitive and memory problems. It turned into really just a waiting game to see what would happen to Zach.
The first day or two are really frightening. There's a lot of ups and downs. There's a lot of instability. And Zach had some features of this. And we always counsel patients' families that watching a patient go through this, it's really a marathon, not a sprint. We won't have our answers within the first few hours or even within the first day.
When the time comes, Dr. Abella slowly begins to warm Zach's body back up. And then?
So I think at that moment that he actually opened his eyes, I had walked out of the room, of course, just like when everything good happens. And my parents were there, and so they came running to say, he moved. He's fluttering his eyes, and he moved.
Soon Zach is thrashing his arms and legs, pulling at all the cords, sort of in this delirious state.
And he looked at me, and I knew he knew it was me, but he didn't quite have the words yet to say very much. I knew he knew that, like, I was someone he loved and that he wanted me close, and he squeezed my hand. But it took, I think, several hours before, like, he could come up with all the words to sort of fill in those pieces.
By the next night, Zach was fully conscious, chatting.
He was, like, up. He was okay. We went to go get some food to eat and bring it back. And before I knew it, I, like, looked down at my phone, and I looked at Facebook, and Zach had posted on Facebook. And he's like, hey, everybody, I'm okay. Just wanted to let you know, thanks. And I'm like, oh my God, he's posting on Facebook. We have to go back. What is going on?
Zach spent another week in the hospital, during which time he had a device implanted in his body. It monitors his heart rhythm and can deliver a jolt if he goes into cardiac arrest again. And it's not really clear if he will. Doctors still aren't sure why it happened in the first place.
They don't know why. There's no obvious indicators. I don't have any structural abnormalities in my heart. There's no genetic things, markers they can find that indicate that this should have happened. It just did.
That randomness is honestly terrifying. But it's something Benjamin Abella sees over and over. So for him, it's more like a problem to solve. Or maybe the way to think about it is therapeutic hypothermia is a treatment, but it's also playing with time. It's like suspended animation, pausing the body to let it recover.
When you're in the business of treating cardiac arrest patients, some of the language and conversations you have are pretty bizarre. And many of us in resuscitation science throw around terms like he was dead, now he's not. And we talk in ways that seem bizarre, but it really is a strange and awkward thing because in every sense of the word, Zach was dead and now he's not. And that's amazing. We're realizing that, yes, death in the first minutes to hours may be a gray area. Historically, it was a very precise line. You were alive and then you were dead. Not as much so anymore, and we're pushing the boundary further and further. And it makes it very exciting, but it does make for some very strange conversations.
Today, Zach is doing pretty well. He and Maura are busy chasing around their twin one-year-olds, and outside of not remembering the cardiac arrest, his brain and heart are working just fine. With its dramatic mountain peaks, crystal clear rivers, and sunny skies, it's hard to imagine being depressed in a place like Aspen, Colorado. But a surprising number of residents of this opulent ski resort struggle with mental health and suicide. And it's not just Aspen. Resort towns across the western U.S. face high suicide rates, too. Marcy Krivenin looks into how these communities are trying to reverse this disturbing trend.
Kim Bayarjan keeps her son Raymond Vieira close. She digs into her purse and pulls out his well-used driver's license. It's bent, and the edges are cracked.
But I keep it because it's his personality. He used to use it when he locked himself out of the house. It's him.
It's a memento Bayarjan holds dear. 2 years ago, Raymond committed suicide. He was 23.
when the knock came on the door and I opened it and there was a sheriff and another person who identified as a coroner to me, and they handed me Raymond's license and said, "This is your son." 6'1", 200-pound, green-eyed, beautiful boy. It's not even expired yet.
Bayarjan is now part of a support group for people with loved ones who have taken their lives. They're meeting tonight.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm Lise.
Nice to meet you.
Warner.
Warner?
Yeah,
Warner. Nice
you
to
really
meet
have
you.
To pucker to say that. Yes,
I'm working.
Hi, how are you?
The group, called Lifeline, meets at coffee shops, in homes, and sometimes at difficult scenes where someone has taken their life. They use their personal experience to help families in the Aspen, Colorado area impacted by suicide. Lise Cohen lost her husband to suicide 13 years ago.
It just is very helpful to just have a group of people who come in who have walked the path and sort of know what could potentially be coming up.
The group's been busy. In the last 4 weeks, there have been 3 suicides. That's a big number for Aspen and its bedroom communities, where about 25,000 people live. Members talk about who needs help and pass around a program from a recent funeral. There are tears, hugs, and long pauses. Sadly, and surprisingly, suicide is just part of life here.
I think people look at the beauty here and wonder, how could anyone ever kill themselves? It's so beautiful.
Michelle Muthing directs the Aspen Hope Center. It provides a 24-hour crisis hotline, and its clinicians are often called to the scene of a suicide to provide on-site counseling. Sure, there's world-class skiing and 5 wilderness areas. People hike, fish, bike, and ski. But Muthing says while the natural beauty may initially draw people here, reality eventually sets in. Just like the peaks they climb, the cost of living in Aspen is sky high, and that puts financial pressure on locals.
Many people come out here for the beauty. They'll say, "I vacationed here as a child and I wanted to move back." So their recollection of a vacation is very different than an adult who has to have a home, work to pay a mortgage or rent, maybe have several jobs to keep afloat.
Substance abuse is another problem. Pitkin County, home to Aspen, has higher rates of binge and chronic drinking than the state and national averages.
When you're finished skiing for the day, you sit slopeside, you have a meal, you have a drink, and then you proceed to continue your evening into dinner, recreation, bars, so on and so forth. So it's very much a party mentality.
We're not just talking about drinking. Aspen's rate of illicit drug use is much higher, according to a state health report. Muthing says partying is part of ski town culture, and that can lead to addiction and a downward spiral. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention reports, on average, someone dies by suicide every 8 hours in Colorado. The top 8 states for the highest number of suicides are in the western U.S. and Alaska. Sarah Brummett with Colorado's Office of Suicide Prevention says the cowboy culture and tough guy mentality in the West can be problematic.
About pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, not showing weakness. There's the real stigma about asking for help or letting someone know that you might be struggling. And that creates a real barrier to people getting help.
Rural parts of the state, like Aspen, often lack mental health services. Colorado is trying to help, spending $500,000 in state money each year on programs to get the suicide rate down. One has gun shop owners displaying gun safety messaging in their stores. Posters suggest gun owners consider off-site storage if a loved one is suicidal. The goal of the programs is to lower the suicide rate 20% by 2024. Aspen isn't alone in this challenge. The resort town Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and its surrounding communities also face a high suicide rate. It's home to a world-class ski area and about an hour from Yellowstone National Park. It's where Adam Williamson does crisis counseling.
We went through a string of suicides. We had around 12 deaths in 20 months, which is a lot for, you know, a small community that we are in.
Williamson and other mental health professionals formed the Teton Valley Mental Health Coalition to identify gaps in local services. They launched ad campaigns, started a suicide survivor support group, and began offering subsidized counseling. The group is tracking data to see if the number of suicides goes down.
We've got a pretty good group of people that are concerned, and a good group of people that are working on it. And I think it's just an issue everywhere. It's a problem everywhere.
Recently, though, Williamson says there has been a marked increase in the number of middle-aged men taking their lives in the area. Back at the meeting of the Lifeline Group near Aspen, Warner Knuhr is sharing his personal story of loss.
I'm still unwilling to go to one-on-one therapy or group therapy. I don't think it is for everyone. I consider this group therapy, by the way.
His son Eric took his life at age 49. It happened 2 years ago this month. His story is eerily reminiscent of Kim Byerjean's.
I'll never forget. The doorbell rang, and there was a sheriff at the door, a tall, imposing man with gray hair, who came in and said, I have some very bad news.
Knuhr says he still asks himself what he could have done to prevent his son's death. He has photographs of Eric up in his house.
I don't want to forget. And I know the wound will heal. Time's the big healer. The scar will never go away.
Byerjean agrees. She tattooed her son Raymond's name on her ankle and has another tattoo on her wrist to remember him. It's a semicolon.
When you complete a sentence or you complete a story, you end it with a period. If the story's going to keep on going, you put a semicolon. And that's what this is about. My story isn't going to end, and I'm not going to let Raymond's story end either.
She's working with her church to reach young adults, like her only son, ski resort workers. Many are in their 20s and arrive in town at the beginning of the season with no friends and family nearby. She wants to connect them to the community, an effort inspired by Raymond's death and a way to keep his memory alive. For The Pulse, I'm Marcy Krivenin.
This is The Pulse. I'm Todd Bookman. The Rio Olympics are coming to a close. They'll likely be remembered as much for the performances of Simone Biles, Michael Phelps, and Usain Bolt as they will be for perhaps misguided concerns over Zika. It seems like the Olympics are frequently an innocent bystander in issues of global consternation, be that Cold War politics or human rights. And if the theory proposed in a new research paper is right, you can add climate change to that list. John Balmes is a professor at UC Berkeley School of Public Health and a co-author of the report. John, welcome to The Pulse.
Thank you.
The title of your piece in this week's Lancet, The Last Summer Olympics. You used a long-range climate forecast model to look at potential host cities. What did you find?
Well, our main goal was to highlight to the world that climate change is real, and it will affect our performance in hot weather, especially hot, humid weather. And we thought we would use the Rio Olympics as a jumping-off point to talk about future Summer Olympics and whether we would even be able to hold them in most cities in the world. And it turns out that by 2085, very few cities will be able to host the Summer Olympics because of hot and humid conditions.
By too hot, Balmes means that competing in an outdoor endurance event like the marathon, the quintessential Olympic sport, would put the athlete at considerable risk for heat stroke. Some caveats here. The paper only looked at cities in the Northern Hemisphere, and only those with a population over 600,000. But the findings are kind of stunning. Outside of Western Europe, which would still have two dozen or so contenders, just two cities in Asia make the grade, none in Latin America, none in Africa. In North America, just three will be cool enough to be considered safe.
Vancouver, Calgary, and San Francisco.
That's it.
Right. And if the projections for climate change get worse, then even those cities wouldn't be available.
Now, your model went out even farther in time. By the 22nd century, is there any place left to hold the Olympics?
The cities would be Dublin, Glasgow, Edinburgh, Belfast.
I mean, there are, of course, some workarounds here, right, John? I mean, the Summer Games don't necessarily need to be played in the middle of the summer, or more events could be held inside. I imagine your real concern isn't dehydrated athletes, right? It's about calling greater attention to what the world's population centers are going to look like?
Exactly. That's why we wrote the article. We want to bring to people's attention something real. You know, it's one thing to be thinking about the polar ice caps receding and polar bears not being able to have the habitat they're used to. But it's another thing for people to consider how the Olympics would be impacted, and then hopefully take that information and transfer it to their own lives and realize that actually farm workers, construction workers, other people that do vigorous work outside are going to be impacted in the future.
And that's actually the main area of his research. It's not marathoners. It's how a warming climate will impact people who make their living outdoors, the people who sweat not for gold or glory, but to earn a paycheck. Those are the folks BOMS is interested in helping. But if it takes a catchier headline about the Olympics to get us to pay attention, well, he says he's fine with that.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse. I'm Todd Bookman, filling in for Mike and Scott. We're talking about temperature on the show this week. Temperature, of course, already plays a big role in medicine. We monitor fevers. We store a lot of drugs in refrigerators. And then there are the plenty of other ways that we apply cold and hot to our bodies. And Pulse reporter Irina Zhurov is here to talk about that. Hey, Irina.
Hey, Todd.
So you grew up in what was then the Soviet Union, where I gather they took their cold baths pretty seriously.
Yeah. So in Russian culture, there's a term for this, zakalenie. It's the practice of teaching yourself to endure increasingly cold baths as a way to strengthen yourself. So, like, if you took cold showers and jumped into frozen lakes in the winter, it improved your immune system, made you stronger, and have, you know, better endurance. And it wasn't restricted to athletes. Lay people did this too, but it was especially for athletes who, in many ways, were the sort of face of Soviet strength.
But I imagine this tradition predates sort of Cold War Olympian bravado, right?
Yeah, I'm guessing it started out as a religious celebration. So the Epiphany, when Jesus was baptized in the Orthodox Church, it's celebrated in January in the dead of winter. And water on that day is considered holy. People go down to the water, they cut holes in the ice, get in the nearby rivers, and it's all to sort of purify. Of course, religion was not really allowed during the Soviet era, so cleansing turned to strengthening, but the winter bathing stayed.
So is this something you did when you were a kid to prove your moxie?
Maybe not to prove my moxie, but I was a ballerina briefly, and I thought this would make me like a stronger, better ballerina, and I took cold showers for a while.
Did it work?
I was never very good. So no, maybe my cold showers were not cold enough. But I do remember, you know, the year after we moved to the States in 1993, there was this huge blizzard. I was sleeping over at a Russian friend's house, and her parents were strict enforcers of this cold regimen. So in this blizzard, we put on shorts and we went for a run around the neighborhood, barefoot, probably also to the horror of her American neighbors.
But today, I mean, top athletes still use cold therapy, right? I mean, after practice, they'll jump into an ice bath. Football teams do this, track athletes. It seems like it's a pretty ubiquitous thing.
Yeah, though the science behind it is still a bit murky. I wanted to learn more, and I wound up at Temple University on the sidelines of their men's soccer team's first practice. 30-some student athletes are kicking around soccer balls in intense, muggy heat. After nearly 2 hours, an athletic trainer for the team, Kendall Stewart, walks away towards a nearby building. Out back is an ice cooler.
These are 40-pound bags of ice. You can grab six of them, probably seven. Cut them open and then dump them in the tub.
He empties the bags into a tub out front. It's a little black stock pool filled with water. The team will soak here to help them recover from the hard workout. The players, meanwhile, finish up practice and walk over to the tub. They peel off sweaty shirts and socks and climb in. On their knees, the water waist deep, the tub holds seven guys. Someone grabs another bag of ice.
Dump it in, kids.
And dumps it in.
Oh.
What's it feel like?
A burning sensation until you go numb, then it feels great.
That's defender Mark Grisella. Team captain Matt Mahoney seems non-committal about whether the ice bath actually helps recovery.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know. Some people say it doesn't, some people say it does. I think it works. I think it's worth doing. I think it's worth a try.
Kendall Stewart, the athletic trainer, doesn't give them much choice about whether they try it or not.
You can stop inflammation at a lower level if you can get someone's muscles to relax and not be overactive, which you would see knots, you would see spasms, and potentially cramping. If I can get all those factors to go away simply by putting someone in an ice tub for 8 to 10 minutes, even if it is a little bit uncomfortable.
It's worth it, he says. And to be clear, this isn't Stewart's special brand of healing voodoo. For decades, ice baths have been totally standard practice for professional and many collegiate athletic programs. And now some institutions have high-tech cold rooms for recovery or cold whirlpools. There are these chambers that use liquid nitrogen to cool the body and high-tech pants and gloves that circulate icy water without getting the athlete wet. No matter the method, the idea is athletes feel less soreness, experience less swelling, and can go hard again the next day.
This is more of a recovery mechanism that athletes will use and not a way to enhance performance.
That's Scott Gunter, a New Jersey-based athletic trainer that works with student and professional athletes.
But when you think about it, if they are able to recover better, then that next practice, they're able to actually give it a little bit more and push themselves. And so in that sense, I guess it can enhance your performance.
Although cold therapy has been used for years, nobody knew exactly what was happening in the body to drive that restoration. Dr. Brian Sennett, chief of sports medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, says understanding of the processes is improving.
It really is an effect on the brain and the central nervous system, an effect on the heart and the strain on our heart system, which we call the cardiovascular system. And the last area, it's also potentially a way to remove breakdown products that build up during exercise.
Let's start with the brain.
There are certain things that get altered chemically in your brain with increasing core temperature.
Those things include serotonin and dopamine, the same chemicals that cause depression when not balanced. Changes in the ratio of those chemicals can also increase our sense of fatigue. So the theory is if an athlete feels like fatigue levels are low, then he or she will perform better.
Sometimes we ask athletes, how do you feel? And they say, I feel good today. And what does that mean? It really means that their perception of their energy levels and their fatigue is like optimal. And many times that's because of what's really going on in the brain, not in their skin, not in their muscles, not in the things downstream. It's really how they feel in their brain.
Then there's the heart. The heart pumps blood throughout the body, sending more of it to the areas that need it at any given moment. For example, when you're eating, more blood goes to your stomach to help digest. And when you're exercising, more blood flows from the core and the organs located there to the skin and muscles. But when the exercise is over,
we want to drive the fluid and the blood from our skin in that periphery back into the central system.
The cold tightens the blood vessels, pushing blood back into the core of the body and to the heart. With more blood flowing to it, the heart doesn't have to work as hard and can start recovering normal operation quicker. The final area of recovery is removing exercise-induced buildup of things like lactic acid and other potentially harmful molecules. Changes in pressure inside the tissue could help drive them out. Even though there's a better understanding of what's happening in the body when an athlete takes a cold plunge, there's still no exact guidelines for how to apply cold therapy. There's no consensus on the temperature that's most effective, and trainers I spoke with recommended anywhere between 8 and 30 minutes as the optimal amount of time to use the therapy. Scott Gunter, the athletic trainer again.
A lot of athletes are superstitious in nature, so they may have a specific ice bath that they want to get into, a specific temperature, a specific amount of time, and then the next day they had a good game.
In other words, like anything in sport, there's still a bit of hocus pocus involved. For The Pulse, I'm Irina Zhurov.
The past few weeks have been hot in Philadelphia, muggy. It's sort of like a rainforest, a foul-smelling rainforest. Maybe nobody has experienced that more than Ernest Rouse.
Oh yeah, I'm on top of the double-decker bus in the sun in 93 degrees.
Rouse works on one of those open-air sightseeing buses, pointing out the city's historical charms to tourists. They're not paying to see him sweat.
If you eat right, you drink right, use the right deodorant, you ain't got to worry about sweat.
Rouse may have his method figured out, but for the rest of the species, sweat is a necessary nuisance. So in these dog days of summer, we asked Pulse reporter Tanya English to look into the evolutionary science and psychology behind perspiration.
Bring your arms up over your head, interlock 10 fingers. Turn to the right.
The fact that you pay money to spend 90 minutes in a super hot room, working out next to a dozen other half-dressed people drenched in body fluid, that's a little ridiculous to me.
You want sweat dripping from your elbows to your knees to your toes. Hold still and release.
Laura Markevich owns Drip 105 Hot Yoga in central Pennsylvania.
So it is 105 degrees in here, and it's around 40% humidity.
Markevich says clients want her to make them sweat because modern people, with our air-conditioned cars and express elevators, don't have a lot of built-in chances to exert ourselves.
Back in the old days, men would go out and work all day, and they'd come home soaking wet, provide for their families because they worked so hard. So it's kind of like this manifestation of our hard work, right? That's why we like sweat.
That kind of sweat is all about thermoregulation. When your temperature creeps too far above 98.6 degrees, the body's cooling system kicks on. Sweat glands send perspiration to the surface of the skin, and heat comes with it. Then evaporation draws that heat away from the body, leaving a film of cooler sweat behind. Perspiration is mostly water, plus a little salt and trace minerals. Hot yoga teacher Laura Markevich says it's pretty clean.
It doesn't have a stink, a body odor.
The perspiration that we work hard for comes from one type of sweat gland. They're called eccrine glands, and they're located all over the body, back of the knees, the forehead, even in your ears. And there's a theory that our ability to sweat gives humans an evolutionary advantage. Imagine your ancestors hunting down an antelope out on the African savanna. Sweat let them stay cool without having to stop, find shade, or pant like a dog.
We were able to actually run our prey down. And so, you know, our endurance in the middle of the day when other animals have to rest maybe served us in getting our food.
Angela Ballard is a nurse educator with the International Hyperhidrosis Society. She helps people deal with uncontrollable excessive sweat. The average person, just sitting around, loses as much as 32 ounces of sweat a day. That's enough to fill a big gulp cup. Ballard says, different from the rest of us, elite athletes start sweating sooner because their bodies are more efficient at keeping cool. So that's one kind of sweat. But there's a second kind of perspiration that we talk about less.
Get four times the protection against stress sweat with Secret Clinical Strength. Stress stinks. Stress sweat doesn't have to.
Stress sweat fuels a multi-billion dollar antiperspirant and deodorant industry.
It's thicker, it's milkier, and it's more of our fight or flight or stress sweat.
Nurse educator Angela Ballard says that kind of sweat comes from apocrine glands, which are clustered in hairy parts of the body. All sweat starts out odorless, but when it's trapped in our armpits and down in our nether regions, it's hard for perspiration to evaporate, and it's that mixture of moisture and bacteria on the skin that can create a funk. But back when we were cave dwellers, BO had a purpose.
And may have helped warn our, you know, clan mates around us that there was something to be scared of, like you could smell fear.
Instead of being triggered by temperature, apocrine glands are activated by embarrassment and anxiety, hormones and emotions. Think back to the Republican primaries. Donald Trump suggested that Senator Marco Rubio's sweatiness said something about his ability to lead.
Did you ever see a guy sweat like Rubio? I've never seen anything like
that. I do think that there's a cultural stereotype there. When we see someone sweating, it means that they're losing their cool. Literally.
That's psychologist Carissa Perry Parrish. She sees people at the Center for Sweat Disorders at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Her patients have conditions that require prescription medicine or even surgery just so they can get through the day.
Like a police officer having a hard time holding on to her firearm because of hand sweating.
Or an elementary student whose classmates won't hold hands to play Ring Around the Rosie because his hands are clammy. Perry Parrish helps her clients deal with the psychological burden of being sweaty all the time. It's a feeling she really understood the last time she went to the farmer's market in 100-degree weather.
And I had sweat rolling down my back. I was like, oh my gosh, this is so gross. So imagine feeling like that every day across every social interaction.
Her clients have real issues to deal with, but maybe the rest of us are a little too freaked out about sweat. After all, sweat is absolutely necessary and inevitable, even if you're not planning on hunting down a gazelle today. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
We'd be remiss to do a show about the cold without taking a trip to one of the coldest places on Earth, Antarctica. It's long been a key destination for groundbreaking research. We got in touch with Douglas Fox, a freelance science journalist who has traveled to the continent 5 times to cover different expeditions. One of those projects was aimed at reaching an ancient lake hidden underneath a half-mile-thick glacier. I asked him just how they attempt to do that.
On one level, it's actually really simple. It's essentially, if you've ever peed into a snowdrift and, you know, you actually create a, your warm pee creates a hole in the snowdrift.
And I've done that. So I now consider myself an Antarctic researcher. We did get a little more serious. Fox explained that the team uses heated water. And he went on to detail what exactly the scientists found.
So, yeah, it's a hot water drill, and this machine in total weighs about 1 million pounds, and it fills several large cargo containers that had to be towed out onto the ice over 600 miles of glacier using a fleet of tractors. So, you know, you're basically just heating water and then lowering a hose down into the hole and gushing hot water. And so it sounds really simple, but it has turned out to be really complicated. All kinds of things can happen down there. The ice, under so much pressure, it's kind of like silly putty. It's not really a solid anymore. And the hole literally gradually oozes shut on you. The hole is only about 2 feet across. So it's 2 feet across and half a mile deep if you get down to the lake. So there's a lot that can go wrong. You can't actually see what is happening. So you really have to kind of go by sort of steering by braille, steering by senses that are not vision. And it's really challenging to know what's happening. Something like 12% of the world's land area is covered under ice, under thousands of feet of ice, sometimes up to a mile, 2 miles, even almost 3 miles. And these areas have never been seen before by human eyes. I mean, there are mountain ranges, entire mountain ranges up to 5,000 or 7,000 feet, lakes and rivers that have never been seen. We only have sort of shadowy indications of them from studies like ice-penetrating radar. So this was really kind of a first glimpse of tapping into this world that has never been seen. When they finally sent the camera down and saw actually mud at the bottom and water, one of the first things they did was sent down a sort of a mud grabber, this series of tubes that were shoved into the mud underneath and brought up. And when they're brought up, you know, the cable's creaking up on the winch and the ice is crackling off of it, and finally this thing comes up, and it just looks like a frozen mudsicle. This dark, glistening mud was dripping off onto the snow, and it's really kind of an amazing thing, because you're in a place where there's nothing but ice for hundreds of miles around. It's just big, flat white on the middle of the West Antarctic ice sheet, and suddenly there's something just so simple and mundane as mud dripping down, and even that is strange. And also just the sense that this stuff hasn't seen sunlight in you know, maybe 100,000, 200,000 years, and depending on the history of this place, maybe as long as 1 million years. And that's just staggering in itself. And people were just really excited that we had actually gotten into the lake. And a few of the people, the crane operators, were later on that day taking the mud and kind of painting whiskers and designs on their faces. It actually, when you touch it, it's full of, it's actually surprisingly gritty, and it's full of this sort of glacially ground shards of rock. But you get it under the microscope and you can see hundreds and hundreds of what look like little pieces of shattered glass, just pure, beautiful curved glass. And these are diatom shells, and there are actually a few diatom shells in there that are relatively intact. And these diatoms, they're microscopic organisms that live in the ocean. They photosynthesize like plants do, and then when they die, they settle down to the bottom of the ocean. And what these were is really a record of a warmer time about 10 to 15 to 20 million years before. I think, you know, it's funny. I mean, the cold, you are there and during the summertime out on the West Antarctic ice sheet, and the cold isn't as extreme as you'd think it was. Just the fact of the first summer I was down there, I was sleeping in a red tent. And just the color of that tent being not white would absorb a lot of sunlight because the sun's there 24 hours a day. And I had a thermometer hanging up in my tent. And sometimes I would wake up in the morning and I couldn't peel my sleeping bag and my clothes off of me quickly enough because the temperature in Fahrenheit, it would be in the 70s or 80s. One time it was actually 98 degrees inside my tent. And this is 84.5 degrees south of the equator, 380 miles from the South Pole. And your body heat is warming the tent, but so is the sun. So it's pretty crazy. It's funny, maybe I've spent 6 or 7 months of my life down there in total, and yet I'd say almost weekly, maybe a couple times per week, I have dreams that are set down there. It's often a very different place. Sometimes there's trees. Sometimes it's the Transantarctic Mountains are covered in juniper and pinyon forest like Arizona where I grew up. But it's always Antarctica, and somehow it just sort of stays with you.
Douglas Fox is a science journalist. There are links to some of his terrific writing at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Irina Zhurov, and Alana Gordon. Alana is working on a story about the pain scale, and we want to hear from you. How do you usually describe pain to your doctor? Does the 0 to 10 scale actually work? Call and leave a voicemail with your name, where you're from, and your story at 215-351-3306. All right, Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Joel Patterson is our managing editor, and Megan Pinto is our executive producer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, you can write a review. Next week on the show, in an era of ones and zeros, who needs buildings full of rotting paper?
People love to talk about the smell of books, and of course when I hear smell of books, I'm like, oh, that's not a good thing. Because when you smell the books, it means the books are deteriorating.
While books may decay, it turns out the role of librarians as guardians of knowledge is being reinvented by a new generation.
When people see my job title, they actually misread it and see human rights activists as opposed to human rights archivists, but I actually don't think that they're very different.
The future of libraries, next week on The Pulse. Mike and we'll be back then. I'm Todd Bookman. Thanks for listening.
Thanks
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.